The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 14, Episode 24. And yes, we've come once again to the final episode of this season. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing three tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Nikki Exposito, Dominic Eagle, and Seth Paul. Tonight we'll hear stories of deadly disappearances, inhospitable houses, and mines of mayhem. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So, lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. Yes, as Season 14 draws to a close, what better way to end than on the end itself, as we look into those who just can't seem to let go of the land of the living. We all wonder what goes on after we're no longer here, but take heart, because as our stories this evening will demonstrate, for some of us it's going to be nice and creepy. Nikki Exposito leads our trip into the afterlife with a story of an accountant who just found out he has more work to do after the star accountant takes a new job, and right in the middle of the busiest time of year. But is it all it appears to be on his social media feeds? Without further ado, I present to you, I'll Kill You After Tax Season. Some places you expect to be haunted. The Hollywood apartment building where I live with my girlfriend, built in 1935, with a creepily out-of-tune piano in the lobby, definitely playing host to a spirit or two. The respiratory hospital, once an insane asylum, my grandmother died in? Basically a malicious presence, Hilton. Murder houses, old churches, my Pasadena elementary school. All ghost catnip. You know what isn't supposed to be haunted? The sleek, modern office building in Century City where I work. Finished in 2019, featured in Architectural Digest magazine. The Century Premium Business Complex is a glass-walled marvel with state-of-the-art security, a private underground parking lot, and an elevator system designed to streamline employee access. The business management firm where I work as a staff accountant, Jorgensen Goldberg Slady, rents out the entire 12th floor. Unexplained supernatural crap shouldn't have existed within miles of the place. But then again, plenty of things shouldn't exist. The water's in the bathroom. Still off, right? Keegan asked me. Christ. They couldn't have picked a better week. I looked up from my computer and nodded. The bathroom in the lobby is open. Screw that. I'll just go down to the 11th floor. Keegan strode off, and I didn't give his potty problem a second thought. He was right. Remodeling a business management firm's bathrooms the first week of March, when every accountant, tax accountant, is neck deep in corporate returns for our clients' many, many loanouts, that has to be a breach of someone's code of conduct. At nearly 10 at night, Keegan and I were camped, still, in the tax office. Management said I wasn't allowed to call it the tax hole. Keegan, the firm's rising star, had buried himself in the cooked books of a new client's monumentally screwed charitable foundation. I, less shiny than Keegan, was trying to wrap up a complicated LLC, and my balance sheet hung off balance by $63. 45 minutes later, I found my mistake. I flipped a 6 and a 9 and straightened up from my monitors to realize that, curiously, Keegan still hadn't returned from the restroom. His screensaver bounced. His Red Bull lingered, forgotten. Was he constipated, I thought? Or maybe he decided he'd hit his daily quota for staring at wonky charity books and decided to go home after his trip to the John. Whatever, I hit my daily quota for staring at K-1s. I shut down my computer and decided I'd talk to Keegan the next day. The next day, though, Keegan didn't come into work, or the day after that. I texted him. He didn't respond. I asked co-workers. They had no idea what was up with him. Finally, on Friday, after no sight of Keegan for nearly 4 days, I consulted Matt, the tax partner. Keegan quit, Matt said plainly. He got a new job. He emailed the partners. Ah, that's bullcrap, I said. It had to be. For starters, no accountant quits a job or finds a new one in the middle of tax season, and especially not an accountant like Keegan. Keegan was a company man with a capital C and M. He'd started as an intern at Jerkins and Goldberg Slatty his junior year of college and gave no indication he wanted to leave ever. He actually said he intended to make partners someday. Quitting in the middle of the night on March the 9th definitely wasn't consistent with Keegan's brand. I'm serious, Matt said defensively. I can show you the email. He clicked on something and beckoned me to the side of his desk. Keegan's resignation email was open on his monitor. Matt, Kevin, Liz, Andrew, and the rest of the JGS team, I apologize for the late notice, but I won't be returning. As of tomorrow, I've accepted an exciting new position at a higher salary at a competing business management firm. Thank you for the professional opportunity you allowed me, and best luck in the future. Sincerely, Keegan Rains. As I read, my low-key concern for Keegan dissipated, and blind fury boiled up to replace it. The asshole quit with zero warning, and since I was the only other tax department junior accountant, he'd essentially guaranteed all his work would be dumped on me. Classy move, dickhead, I texted him. After tax season, I'm going to kill you. For a while, I didn't think much about Keegan. I mean, I didn't forget about him. I remembered I had a work buddy named Keegan Rains and that he'd quit without notice. And whenever I was assigned a new mammoth tax return marked up with Keegan's notes, I'd shake my fist at the sky and curse him. But the unsettling weirdness surrounding his disappearance ceased to bother me. Until late May. On my way into the building as I waited for the parking lot sensor to read my security placard, I watched a tow truck drive in the opposite direction out of the lot toward the street. A Toyota blue Honda Civic with a Cal State Northridge bumper sticker and a Playa del Rey surf decal on the back window. Keegan's car. All of a sudden, clarity knocked me down like a tidal wave. Keegan vanished weeks before, in the middle of the night, after going to take a piss on the 11th floor. He never answered my texts or calls. He'd quit by sending the partners a short, odd email that sounded like it was written by a cheap AI. And apparently, His Honda had been parked in the building lot since then. No one else in the office shared my concern. "Are you sure it was Keegan's car?" Matt said. "There's a lot of civics in the world." "Do you really think he's the first employee to quit at an inopportune time?" Lisa, the senior tax accountant, droned boredly. "It's not like he's in any actual danger, is he?" one of the bookkeepers said confidently. "Haven't you seen his Facebook account?" I hadn't. I log on to Facebook about once a year to respond to happy birthday messages from my aunt and my grandparents. But social media was an avenue I hadn't explored yet. I did follow Keegan on Twitter and Instagram, and both accounts, I soon realized, had been deleted. I typed Keegan Rains into the Google search bar on my phone, and a Facebook page popped up. In his profile picture, Keegan, with gelled back hair and a sterile smile, posed in front of a blurry, indistinguishable office building in a sport coat and striped tie. The photo banner was a photo of the Los Angeles skyline. The education section of his profile listed a bachelor's in accounting from Cal State Northridge. No employment information. I scrolled down. His entire wall seemed to be a series of generic quotes, the type you'd see on a corporate pamphlet. "Do or do not, there's no try. Yoda." The losers sit around and cry about the injustices done to them. Winners turn those injustices into fuel to ignite the fire within. They sleep. We grind. Useless wannabe inspirational crap like that. Keegan had created the page recently, on March 10th, the day after I'd last seen him. New job, new Facebook profile. The first post was a photo, taken in a bright restaurant with exposed brick walls and blue flowers, of Keegan and a woman. The woman was slender and willowy with long red hair and wide-set blue eyes. "At Lola Trattoria, with Bay," the tag read. "Bay? New girlfriend, too, apparently." Keegan had had a girlfriend, I remembered. I met her at a couple office parties, and she definitely wasn't the woman in the photo. The girlfriend I'd known was short and round-faced, with glasses. The chick in this Facebook picture? Couldn't put my finger on it, but she was wrong somehow. Like one of those cursed images people put on Tumblr. The longer I stared at her face, the more uncomfortable I became. I went through Keegan's friends list instead. It was short, only 31 people, and it was odd. Not odd because I didn't recognize any of them. Plenty of people don't follow their coworkers on Facebook, but because they all seemed so random. Like there was no one from Northridge, or the Jesuit high school Keegan attended, or his surfing club, or his amateur photography meetups. Just a series of moderately attractive young professionals from an assortment of cities. Stephanie, a junior advertising executive in Minneapolis. James, an intellectual property attorney in New Orleans. Adriel, marketing manager in New York. Rick, software engineer in London. I logged on to my own account and sent Keegan a friend request, then put the strange Facebook page to the back of my mind and focused on work. It wasn't until later that day, as I headed down to the lobby for lunch, that the most glaring oddity of Keegan's disappearance knocked me upside the head. He said he was going to the bathroom on the 11th floor. The way the elevators are programmed in our building, you need to scan an ID card. My ID card, Keegan's card, the card belonging to anyone in my office only got us to our office on the 12th floor. I couldn't, say, pop into the ad agency on the 15th floor unless someone who worked there called down to security and explicitly requested I be allowed up. Then security could program me a temporary badge. But even if Keegan had managed to game the system or obtain a temporary badge, he still couldn't have gotten to the 11th floor from ours. You see, different elevators are programmed to go to specific places, and ours was programmed for the 12th to the 18th floors. So if Keegan wanted to go to the 11th floor, he'd need to take the elevator back down to the lobby, then get on a second different elevator, which seemed like a lot of effort for a quick pee. Maybe he'd gone down the stairs instead. I tested that hypothesis that afternoon. I entered the stairwell through the emergency exit at the back of my office, and I clambered down one set of fire stairs to a platform, then another flight, and another platform, and a third flight, and another platform, this one with a push door. The door was unlocked. I shoved my way through it and into the West Coast Life insurance lobby, face to face with a pissy-looking receptionist. West Coast Life Insurance rented the 10th floor, so the stairs just skipped the 11th. "What do you want on the 11th floor?" the tired-looking security guard asked me, a suspicious frown on his face. I smiled at him placatingly. I started, "How would I get there? To, use the bathroom if I needed to." "You can use the bathrooms in the lobby or the parking lot," he replied sternly. "There's nothing on the 11th floor." My eyes involuntarily twitched toward the guard's own ID card, sitting on the desk by his computer. I knew, and he knew I knew, that security staff's cards function as master keys for the elevator, able to override the system and access any floor. "There's nothing on the 11th floor," the man repeated, nearly snarling. "You don't ever need to go there. No one needs to go there." "Some people," a switch just goes off in their head, said blonde, dimpled lawyer Kyle, "like lemmings, but instead of jumping off a cliff, they quit their job." My girlfriend, Tara, is an entertainment lawyer. Before you ask, yes, she makes considerably more than I do. But she's got 3 years of USC law school loans to pay back. My accounting degree from night school, which I bartended to pay rent, after it became apparent my dreams of success as a movie stuntman weren't going to pan out, had been a considerably less hefty financial investment. So, for the moment at least, we're equal. She works in Century City as well, a couple of blocks from my office. On summer Fridays, we do happy hour at one of the neighborhood cocktail bars. I brought Keegan along a few times. That day, though, it was me and the lawyers. "I used to work as an in-house counsel for a marketing firm in Manhattan," Kyle continued. "This smoking hot blonde chick worked there, Adriel. At the firm Christmas party, she said she was going to an empty office to call her boyfriend. None of us ever saw her again." "But she's alive, right?" Tara cut in through sips of her martini. Kyle nodded. "Yeah, she's still on social media and everything. She just cut and ran, stopped talking to everyone at work. Even the other chicks she was real tight with. No idea why she did it. She was, the partner's golden child. If she wanted more money, I'm sure they would have given her a raise." The topic of conversation shifted to a married client's affair with a pool boy, but Lord Carl's words bounced around in my head. Blonde, Adriel, the missing Manhattanite yuppie. Her story was disturbingly similar to Keegan's. Beloved employee gone in an instant with no explanation. Adriel made a call in an empty office. Keegan took a piss on an abandoned floor. But also, I knew Adriel, or at least I knew where to find her. On Facebook, on Keegan's friends list. As soon as Tara and I returned to our apartment, I logged onto Facebook. Keegan had apparently rejected my friend request. I found Adriel's page, Adriel March. She was, as Kyle reported, a pedestrian, pretty blonde, with dimples and a nice ass. In her profile picture, she lifted a green cocktail, smiling saucily. Her banner, like Keegan's, was a cityscape, New York instead of Los Angeles. BA in marketing management from Barack College, employed as a marketing manager at Yellow Flower Media. Her profile was littered with self-important, rise-and-grind quotes, a dash of lean-in corporate feminism sprinkled over the top for flavor. She said she could, and so she did. Most girls dream of marrying the smartest, strongest, richest boy. I'd rather be smarter, stronger, and richer than all the boys. Her profile was older than Keegan's, and she'd posted more pictures. Her sitting with a Ken doll-looking man at a trendy sushi restaurant, grinning, ready to run the New York Marathon. More colorful drinks surrounded by an interchangeable herd of inoffensively pretty blondes. Leaned against the railing, East River behind her, Manhattan skyline, beyond the river, arms wrapped around a skinny redhead with wide-set blue eyes. Bay, I recognized. Keegan's girlfriend. Adriel tagged her by name. Rosla Drawn. Sight of the girl, Rosla, gave me the same unsettled, indistinctive gut kick she had before. It was her eyes, or her alien skinny arms, or the drape of her red tank top. Something. What sort of name was Rosula, anyway? I clicked out of Facebook and onto Google, Yellow Flower Media. If I could find where Adriel worked, then, well, then I didn't know. A few pages popped up, a couple LinkedIn accounts, including Adriel's. Next, I found the Yellow Flower Media corporate website itself. For a marketing firm, their site was, well, forgettable. It was as though they'd gone out of their way to make their internet footprint as drab, dull, and generic as possible, from the off-white background in Times New Roman font to the links that didn't work to the About Us section, which consisted of a single, barely readable paragraph. Something about ROI to drive content engagement with search engine optimization through business-to-business synergy in the brand space. It read like the work of a chatbot with Tourette's. With a sudden burst of inspiration, I pulled up the Wayback Machine. I searched for Yellow Flower Media, and in a second I had a hit. Yellow Flower Media was a marketing firm in East Midtown Manhattan. They'd worked with internet startups in the late 90s and early 2000s, and then permanently closed in 2005. That Saturday, I drove to Fairy Tale Cafe, a Koreatown coffee place, with big tables and comfy chairs to study for the CPA exam. It was something I needed to do, study, take the exams, get certified. I'd been procrastinating because everything associated with the CPA exam was about as interesting as watching grass grow. But I needed a break. A break from disappearing blondes and ghost marketing agencies, from Facebook and creepy Rosula Drone, from Keegan's old clients and Keegan's empty desk and just Keegan. I couldn't deal with how much space the guy took up in my head. In line for my coffee, though, I was rudely reminded of how I knew about Fairy Tale Cafe in the first place. Keegan took me there once. He lived in Koreatown. It was Keegan's face I found myself staring into, his photograph printed on a flyer pinned up on the cafe's community board. Missing person. Keegan Rains, 25 years old, 5'10", brown hair, hazel eyes. Missing since March 10th. I felt like a 100-pound baseball bat hit me square in the chest. I nearly sunk to my knees right there, overcome with both vindication and abject terror. I wasn't crazy or exaggerating. Keegan had gone missing under suspicious circumstances. There was a number on the flyer. I sat down at a table and dialed it, and a young woman answered. I saw your flyer. I started weakly. I was a friend of Keegan's, and I think we should talk. Do you know the Fairy Tale Cafe? Stupid, of course. You know it. That's why the flyer's there. Give me 10 minutes, the woman cut in, and then hung up. 10 minutes later, a young Korean woman with a round face, curly hair, and glasses walked into the Fairy Tale Cafe. I waved her over. I knew her. She was Keegan's girlfriend, or ex-girlfriend, Lauren. Laura? You're Francis, right? She asked as we sat down. I remember you from the Christmas party. Yeah, I said, and you're Lauren? Leslie, she corrected. He wanted to talk about Keegan. I saw him that night. He said he was going to the bathroom on the 11th floor, and then he was gone. Even in my head, I sounded like an idiot. But Leslie stared appreciatively. So you were the last person to see him? I think so. Keegan had been off for a while, she explained. It started small. She'd find him staring, unblinking, into space for minutes at a time. Then those stare-at-nothing attacks began happening while he was driving. He'd miss a turn or a freeway exit on a road he'd taken so many times, muscle memory should have kicked in. The two of them liked trying new restaurants a couple times a week. For these outings, Keegan began suggesting random places he claimed his friends recommended. Leslie would Google the name and find out Keegan's suggestion was a restaurant shut down long ago. Some were relics that hadn't been opened since Keegan was a small child. Next was movies. Keegan would throw out a film title, again a recommendation from a friend or co-worker that didn't exist. Or sometimes when Leslie would search for a movie, she'd find it had been a project a famous actor or director had been attached to, then abandoned. "We got together in college," Leslie told me. "We were supposed to get engaged this year." Then he stops answering his phones and responding to texts and sends me a 6-word email. "I think we should break up." "Does he have any family?" I asked. "Only child. Mom died last year. Doesn't talk to his dad. If he has any grandparents or cousins or aunties, I don't know." "Did you see his Facebook page?" I ventured. She nodded. "He's got a LinkedIn, too. Apparently he's working for some business management firm called Crowley Wilkes & Company, with no address, no phone number, and no online reviews. He writes like ChatGPT got drunk and tried to mimic white guy who works in an office. It's not him, Francis. Someone is pretending to be Keegan online. AI, or a Russian troll, or the redhead," I offered. Leslie stared at me, eyes wide and wild. "Like I said, that isn't Keegan in those pictures. It can't be. My Keegan's gone." Leslie and I didn't have much more to say to each other, so I went home. I logged back into Facebook and opened Keegan's page. He'd added to it. A few more generic motivational speaker quotes and some photos. Whoever Facebook Keegan was, he knew enough about real Keegan to recreate his hobbies. A whole series of shots captured Keegan at the beach with his surfboard. In one, he and Rosula Dron posed with their arms snaked around each other. Again, Rosula's wrongness hit my brain like an off-key note in a song. My breath caught in my throat. I figured it out. One of Rosula's slender, pale, freckled arms was wrapped around Keegan's waist. Another slender, pale, freckled arm terminated in a dainty hand clasping Keegan's chin. A third slender, pale, freckled arm clutched a yellow surfboard. Either this chick had three arms, or she'd been poorly photoshopped. Her eyes were two-dimensional. Her shadow went the wrong way. In one bikini shot, her belly button was missing. Whoever or whatever managed Keegan's Facebook page, Adriel March's Facebook page, and all their friends' Facebook pages had an uncomfortable stranglehold over information on the surface web. Utilizing Wayback Machine, though, I found traces of the people they used to be. I uncovered an old Instagram profile belonging to Stephanie, the junior advertising executive from Minneapolis. Before her posts abruptly stopped in 2019, she shared photos of her ugly dog and thoughts that weren't yuppie cliches. I dug up an old cooking blog she kept as a side project by James, the intellectual property attorney in New Orleans. The last entry, dated 2020, detailing James' adventures making sourdough bread, had 56 comments. All some version of, "Where are you, man?" Or, "Please call me, sweetie." Or, "I just want to know you're alive." A missing persons report had been filed by the family of Rick, the London software engineer, back in 2015. Crowley, Wilkes & Company, an LA-based management firm, shut its doors permanently in 2011. Lola Trattoria, the aesthetically pleasing Italian restaurant where Keegan posed with Rosella, went under in 2009. Suddenly, a Facebook message popped up, catching my attention. A direct message from Rosula Drone. Want friend? I was seized by burning panic. Who are you? I responded. Want you my friend? Where's Keegan? I typed. Keegan mine. Mine, mine, mine. You my friend? Will you be my friend, Francis? My stomach hit the floor. How did she know my name? I closed out of Facebook and turned off my computer. I needed answers, and I knew where I needed to go to get those answers. It wasn't really an advertisement for building security, just how easily I snuck past the night guards. I cased the joint for a few days. After 8, only 2 security guards watched over the lobby. The east side security guard kept his headphones in and his eyes down, only looking up in response to footsteps or voices. The west side security guard, a guy about my age and my build, always came up with a big thermos of coffee and between 9 and 9:30 retreated to the bathroom for 10 to 12 minutes. The next Friday, I ducked into a stall in the men's lobby room. I waited there until I saw the black slacks and shined shoes of the west side security guard in the stall next to mine. Then I threw on a black jacket, the same style the security team wore, and sauntered confidently to the west side security desk. The east side security guard barely glanced at me as I snatched up my west side security guard's key card. The electricity was out on the 11th floor, but the glass walls allowed in all the moonlight and streetlight I needed to find my way around. Over the reception desk, metallic letters, CWC, still hung. The office layout mimicked mine, mostly open plan, with glass-walled private workspaces for seniors and partners. I got the impression whatever business once rented this place had left in a hurry. Boxes of file folders rested in collapsing pyramids and piles, around overturned desks and picked-apart electronics. A thin coat of dust rested over everything. I looked down and saw a trail of shoe prints. I followed the shoe prints past scattered plastic flowers and busted printers and crates of unopened mail and dried-out highlighters and metallic file cabinets, empty, drawers still hanging agape. Then the prints stopped. It took an earth-shattering minute for my brain to process the thing in front of me. A body. A human body. Eyes decomposed. Skin leathery and brown, like a prop mummy at a haunted house. Long yellow nails, lips, dust, nose, teeth, burrowing maggots, patches of curly brown hair, khaki pants, green shirt. Keegan's green shirt. Keegan, Keegan, Keegan. Beyond Keegan, there were more. The second corpse had been reduced to a gray husk. The dirty white skeleton of a third sprawled between desks like discarded debris was all that remained. "Did you find what you came for, Francis?" chirped a female voice, like a robot on an answering machine. I spun around. It was Rosula. Rosula loomed over me like a monstrous, ill-proportionate cardboard cutout. Nearly as tall as the ceiling on stick-thin legs, her wiggling arms nearly brushed the ground, red hair, an unmoving mold, long fingers too long. A toothy smile cut across her two-dimensional face. Her eyes bulged like a squeezable toy, morphing and twisting and flattening, flickering and glitching like a demented hologram. She reached for me. I turned to run and felt my feet stick to the floor. It coated the scattered documents, the abandoned desks, the forgotten office supplies. It dripped from the ceiling down the glass walls, pooled on the floor. A shimmering, gelatinous substance, the color of spit, the consistency of maple syrup. It throbbed. It gathered itself around the three bodies, hugging them, engulfing them. It reared up in little tendrils like a curious nest of snakes, tentatively sniffing me, sensing me, figuring me out. The substance sparkled, jittered, like it was something it couldn't be, pixelated. Then I felt warm, breathing ropes wrap themselves around my ankles. I wasn't built to work in an office. I was supposed to be a professional stuntman. I jerked, kicked, and twisted my body, breaking away from the pixelated jelly's grasp. It hissed. I whirled to face Rosula. Eyes red, teeth bared, she lunged at me with her alien hands. I dove, I rolled between her legs, and I ran. I ran for the emergency exit and burst through the door, tearing apart plaster and plywood, and threw myself down the fire stairs. Stairs, platform, stairs, platform. I ran and ran and ran, not pausing, not thinking, until I felt the warm summer night air on my face. Outside the Century Premium business complex, I collapsed into the grass, coughing and panting and sobbing. I lay on the ground until I'd regained enough of my reality to realize I needed to get myself up and go home. I sat and stared back at the sleek modern office building. Through the glass walls, I saw faces. Rosula shifting and flickering like a low-budget cartoon. Keegan, Adriel March, all their Facebook friends. The passably pretty, stolen young professionals gone forever from our world, trapped perpetually in that colorless, pixelated slime. They didn't look unhappy. I should have quit my job, now that I'm aware of the otherworldly horror that exists just feet below me. If I were smart, I'd never set foot in Century Premium Business Complex ever again. But why? That predatory, gelatinous stuff kidnapped yuppies from London, New Orleans, New York, all sorts of places, all over the world. At least here, I know where it lives. I've been doing some reading about pocket dimensions. I don't pretend to understand the physics, but getting my head around the concept has allowed me to come up with a theory of what exactly I faced down on the 11th floor. The shimmery living gelatin that comes from a pocket dimension. Or it is a pocket dimension itself. Whatever. One way or another, it collects things from our dimension. Non-existent movies, shuttered businesses, closed bars and restaurants, and sometimes people. People like Keegan. And it either keeps them as pets or consumes them for energy. Given the quick decomposition of Keegan's body, I'm leaning towards the latter. The internet is an interface with our dimension. It might use social media to stalk targets or to lure them in. Or else Facebook and LinkedIn are a form of camouflage. If Keegan is still posting on Facebook, then he's still alive and well, and we don't have to look for him. Therefore, we don't find the living goo on the 11th floor. Places like the 11th floor are portals, maybe, between universes. Or a colony. Or an outpost of sorts. Rosula is its avatar. Like the photos it creates and the written language it produces, Rosula is a lousy forgery. She resembles a human being, just not quite close enough. She didn't want me. It wanted me. It seeks out the cream of the crop, only the best employees. Except now, I think I impressed it. Lately, I've caught myself staring into space, imagining happy hour cocktails at Lola Trattoria, recalling that hilarious story Adriel told us, considering which movie I should recommend for Keegan to see on Friday with Rosula. Then I remembered Lola Trattoria is closed and Keegan is dead. Some places aren't supposed to be haunted. Some things shouldn't exist. And some people were never meant to work in an office. But they are, and they do, and I am. Yesterday, I rode the elevator up to work. I realized an extra button had appeared. The 11th floor. I hope you enjoyed I'll Kill You After Tax Season by Nikki Esposito, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Nikki-Esposito. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/NICKY-EXPOSITO. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Why, I knew that job sounded too good to be true. Or maybe it's too true to be good? Wait, that doesn't sound right. Let's just go with the idea that the job is dead on for them. Yeah, that's better. While our last story didn't expect such a reception in a modern office building, in this tale from Dominic Eagle, well, I guess we get the sort of place you really expect of a good haunting. A house with an old and tragic history that's just the kind of place that kids dare each other to enter. Sounds like good, clean fun, right? Without further ado, I present to you A Night in the Hawthorne House. There's a house beyond the town, beyond all towns, beyond all worlds, the Hawthorne House. Ghost stories rarely carry much weight, but there is something deeply off-center about the forlorn manor at the edge of town. Many have doubted that, of course, but I've never met a skeptic who left the haunted place unchanged. Plenty of naysayers have come and gone over the years. They've heard the stories, and they wanted to see the house for themselves. The tales of terror are endless. Hauntings. Disappearances. Killings. Hawthorne House. It is a hole unfit for living things. A fractured abode housing nothing but the vile spirits and viler memories. The people of my town dare not step foot in the long-abandoned property, for it has borne witness to unspeakable events. The business of the missing girl in 1999 was awful enough, as was the story I'm about to tell. But the house wasn't content with one, two, or even three tragedies. Why, just a few months ago, there was the dreadful incident of the religious cultists found slaughtered in the upstairs bathroom. There was a time, however, that the Hawthorne House signified class and sophistication, and I would learn of that as a child whilst we were driving past the petrifying property. "I've always hated the place," I said, shuddering. "Me too," my mum agreed. "You should both mind your manners. That was my sister's home," my great aunt Shirley said, Sarah Hawthorne. My mother's jaw dropped, and I raised an inquisitive eyebrow. "What? Your sister died when you were young, Auntie Shirley. You're getting confused." Shirley shook her head. "Don't be so patronizing, Anna. I'm not senile yet. I know my own history. I've just never told you, that's all. Sarah Jackson, that was her name. She married Jonathan Hawthorne, and they had a child, Bert Hawthorne. He died at the age of 10, and I wasn't lying when I said my sister also died young. The boy's parents couldn't go on without him. They took their own lives. Barely 30 years of age, the pair of them." "I'm sorry. Just what? Are you telling me that we're related to the Hawthornes? The family who lived in that dire place?" my mother asked, practically hyperventilating. all of the horrible things that happened there? I don't even know what... Why are you telling me now?
I'm not long for this world, dear, Shirley said, nodding her head at me. And it doesn't seem fair for little Johnny to think badly of his family.
Think badly of his... My mum stopped, guffawing. People say dreadful things about the Hawthorns. To know that we're related to them, it's just...
This is why I never said anything, Shirley sighed. I knew you'd react badly, just like everybody else in town.
I just don't know how you could keep a secret, my mum gasped.
Someone at school said they killed old man Dalton's brothers in the 50s. I said, is that true, Shirley? She nodded, and my mother gripped the steering wheel firmly.
Enough of this, you two.
Shirley, we'll talk about this later.
Oh, do stop being so melodramatic, dear, Shirley huffed. They weren't the monsters that everybody portrayed them to be. Those Dalton boys killed poor Bert Hawthorne.
I know the story, my mum whispered. That doesn't make your sister's retaliation any less dreadful.
That conversation took place when I was only 10 years of age, and it stuck with me. I was a Hawthorne. My mom was right. It wasn't good to have that name tied to us. The older I got, the more I learned about the history of the place, the more I realized that I'd have a target painted on my back if the word were ever to get out, and one day that's exactly what happened.
Johnny Hawthorne,
Samuel Gray shouted. The year was 2010. I was 16 years old, on the cusp of leaving high school. If only it had remained a secret for a few more months, I so nearly escaped the tyrant of our year. Samuel Gray, the bully who bullied bullies. Practically a boy in a man's body. You know the one. The kid who grew taller and wider than anyone else. The type of fearsome chap whose cronies remained loyal only because he was such a broad, menacing figure, not because anybody actually respected him. No. They feared him. Even my friends didn't have the courage to stick by my side as Samuel came stomping across the playground with several lackeys in tow.
Is it true, Johnny?
The grunt growled, grabbing a fistful of my school t-shirt.
Are you really a Hawthorne?
I stammered.
What? How?
I heard your mom talking to my mom about it. Michael Baker sheepishly said, peering around his side of the boss. I felt a little betrayed. Michael had once been my buddy. His mother and my mother were close friends. I didn't understand why he'd throw me under the bus. Then again, most children would have thrown their own mothers under the bus if Samuel Gray had ordered them to do so.
Never mind that, the bully said, lifting me off the ground. Is it true?
I sighed, realizing there was no use in lying. My great-aunt was Sarah's sister.
Told you,
Michael meekly muttered, unable to meet my gaze.
So you're the descendant of child killers, Samuel asked, narrowing his eyes.
I understood why he felt so slighted by this revelation. Samuel was a burgeoning sociopath, a boy setting his sights on a life of terrible endeavors. He definitely planned to be a killer with his own legacy one day. He seemed to envy my awful ancestry. The Dalton brothers killed Bert Hawthorne, I choked. Jonathan and Sarah acted in revenge. I should have held my tongue.
What?
Samuel wailed, lifting me higher.
Are you making excuses for your child killer ancestors?
Come on, Samuel, Michael said. Let's go before...
Quiet, worm,
Samuel ordered, and his soldier fell in line.
Do you know old man Dalton Hawthorne?
It's Jackson, I corrected. Hawthorne, Samuel viciously insisted. Don't test my patience. I'll only ask you one more time. Do you know old man Dalton?
Jeffrey Dalton?
Yes, I answered. He had three brothers. They walked into the Hawthorne house, and they were never seen again. He snarled. Your bloodline did that. After the brothers killed Bert Hawthorne, I firmly protested, desperately trying to defend myself against the bully. What Jonathan and Sarah did was deplorable, but it was nothing to do with me. It was a tragic accident on the train tracks, Samuel growled, seemingly agitated that his intimidation wasn't having the desired effect. Then the bully's eyes softened and his smile turned wicked, as if he'd suddenly thought of the most wonderful idea. Wonderfully horrifying idea. He had. After school, we're going to go for a little walk, Johnny, he said. Don't bother trying to run. You know we'll find you. I did know that. Countless children had tried to swerve Samuel Gray over the years, and it hadn't ended well for any of them. Freddie May could attest to that. The boy was left with a limp in year 7, a limp that would stay with him for the rest of his life. His leg never quite healed properly. So when the final bell sounded at 3:30, I walked toward the gates at the entrance of the school. Pitying children watched me walk by. Everyone knew what happened. I was a dead man walking, a classmate on death row. Walking towards a bleak, almost certain doom at the hands of Samuel Gray and his begrudging cronies. Smart man, the bully said approvingly, nodding his head as I approached the trio of boys. I thought you might run. Let's just finish this, Sam, I sighed. The boy frowned. I don't like your tone, Johnny Hawthorne. Do you know what happened to the last person who gave me attitude? Gary, why don't you tell him? Gary, his only joyous, passionate disciple, grinned as Samuel burnt his lip with a match. He won't give me any lip ever again, the head goon chortled. I nodded, feigning amazement at Samuel's unimpressive tale. Where are we going? I asked. The bully suddenly put an arm around my shoulder and patted my chest. Let's walk and talk, Johnny. Walk and talk. Tell me, what do you know of your family's history? What did Auntie Shirley tell you about her sister? I shrugged as we started to walk away from the school. Just that we were related. We never really talked about it, and she told me the truth. Samuel smiled. Well, let me tell you all about your heritage. The year was 1957. Jonathan and Sarah Hawthorne brought little Bird into the world, and all was well. They were the most powerful people in the village, but they were also loved. Of course, even nice folk have haters, don't they? And the Dalton boys weren't a big fan of Bertie Hawthorne in his life of luxury. Who can blame them, really? The rich eat the poor, no matter how nice they may be. If only you were to put this much effort into your homework, I thought. The bully continued. One day, the Daltons, tired of the Hawthorns, Jeffrey, old man Dalton, was too young to play out with his brothers, but the other three took Bert in a walk. Much like the one we're taking today, Johnny. Ah, the cycle of time. I knew the destination that Samuel had in mind for us. Blake Dalton had a proposition for Bert. He told the boy that Dalton brothers would stop pestering. He only had to do one simple thing. Hand over his Cartier wristwatch. Worth hundreds, perhaps thousands of pounds. The type of trinket that Jonathan Dalton could afford with a day's wage, most likely, was nothing to him. A drop in the sand. But to the Daltons, that money could have changed their lives. And Bert, the spoiled brat, refused. Samuel snarled. So they killed him? I asked bluntly. Seems fair. You know what, Johnny Hawthorne? Why don't you ask them yourself? He roared. We rounded a corner, and I found myself facing exactly what I expected to face. The horror at the edge of the town. The place our parents always told us to skirt around. Hawthorne House. Legend says that the souls of Blake, Drew, and Percy rest in that haunted place. Samuel whispered, placing his hands on my shoulders and squeezing painfully. What do you think, Johnny? I wanted to lie, wanted to tell the monster that ghosts weren't real. But I didn't believe that, and I seemed unable to bring my lips to utter those words. Truthfully, looking upon the crooked abode, I never felt so terrified, never felt so sure that a thing didn't belong. You want to go inside, don't you? I quietly asked. Oh, not just that, Johnny. Samuel laughed, pushing me across the road. I want you to spend the night.
But don't worry, Gary chortled, with a gormless expression. We won't leave you on your own, you little baby. Samuel sighed as we reached the gate to the ominous house. Yes, Gary, I was getting to that if you just let me finish for crying out loud. Sorry, Gary whimpered. The leader rolled his eyes and pushed the gate open, dragging me along the weed-littered path leading up to the front door. The two lackeys, Michael and Gary, followed in his hesitant wake. You made your point, Samuel, Michael said. Let's just go home. Johnny's learned his lesson. I expected the leader to react with fury, but he simply giggled. Oh, it's too late to grow a backbone now, Mikey. You've already thrown your dear old friend under the bus. Isn't that right, Johnny? I didn't respond, but I did cast a fleeting glance in Michael's direction, finally meeting his eyes. My gaze was met with a look of burning shame from my once friend. Good, I thought. Samuel knocked on the door roughly. Hello, ghosts and ghouls? Your grandnephew's paying a visit. Gary chortled uncomfortably. I could sense that he, like the rest of us, feared the Hawthorne house. Even Samuel Gray felt its power. The bravado was a front. When the property door creaked in response to his knocking, I saw the flash of horror in his eyes. Only for a second, but it was there. He was trying to prove something, and none of us were fooled. Still, nobody wanted to be on the brute's bad side. As dumb and cowardly as he may have been, he packed a mean punch. You first, Johnny, Samuel said. They're your relatives, after all. They won't mind if you open the door. I gulped and nodded, only wanting to end the terrifying ordeal. With shaking hands, I pushed the front door, horrified to find that the wood buckled and opened, needing only a delicate, unwilling push. I'd hoped it would stand firm and we could all have gone home. Instead, we found ourselves standing in an expansive lobby, illuminated by the late afternoon light of an autumnal day. It was undoubtedly a spectacular place once upon a time, but the Hawthorne husk reeked of nightmares, residual trauma from decades of unthinkable events. It was filled with hollowness, though such a thing hardly makes sense. The wooden steps were rotten, and they led up to frightening paintings on the second floor, one for each of the Hawthorne family members. Sarah? Jonathan? Bert? Samuel called, giggling as we stepped inside. You want to come and say hello to Johnny? No reply. Well, that's not very polite, is it? Samuel huffed, sternly placing his hands on his hips. You're youngest member of the bloodline, the future of your family. Not by name, perhaps, but by blood. He's right here. I've heard some horrible things about this place, Michael said. Samuel groaned. Yes, we've all heard horrible things, Michael. Stop being a baby. Hawthorns? Are you there? You've got a limited window if you want to say hello to Johnny. Soon, he'll be gone. He'll join Bert in the dirt. Upon hearing that final line, the house shrieked in a drawn-out note, a resounding wail of disgust at Samuel's distasteful comment. The bully's face froze, much as it had on the doorway. His brash facade was failing. Screw this, Sam, Michael whined. I'm getting out of here. My old friend threw the front door open and yelled fearfully. Gary, Samuel, and I looked towards the door, and we unleashed similar cries of fright. The world outside had vanished. Beyond the doorway, there only lay an endless void of blackness. What the? Gary began. Samuel's eyes widened, and he fell silent for the first time in his life. I merely stood and watched. The existential nature of our situation finally dawned on me. I'd always known the stories about the Hawthorne house to be true. I'd always believed in ghosts, and I was about to become yet another casualty of the haunted household. A creak sounded from Gary's corner of the room, and we twisted our heads to find an impossibility. Gary, Samuel cried, where are you? The boy had evaporated, fled into nothingness.
The room was large and it had numerous doorways, but he would have heard his footsteps. He would have seen him leave the room. The schoolboy had simply ceased to be.
"This is your game, isn't it, Johnny? You're playing a trick on us," Samuel hissed, lunging at me.
We toppled to the floor and I wrestled with the boy, but it was far too strong for me.
"You and your family of witches," he growled, before tightening his hands around my throat. "My granddad told me all about you. The Daltons were his friends, and you butchered them all." "Samuel, stop!" Michael cried as the light started to fade from my eyes. "You're killing him!"
My old friend tried to pull the bully off me, but Samuel flung him to the ground like a rag doll.
"Stay out of this, worm. There's only one way we'll make it out of here, and that's by ending the man-witch, ending the bloodline."
My head fell to the side as Samuel choked me, and my blurring eyes looked upon the paintings lining the top floor. The canvases seemed black and colorless to my eyes. I could no longer see the father, the mother, and the boy in their individual portraits, but I could see growing shadows behind Samuel. Vague, translucent shapes. With a sudden rush of movement, one of the ethereal forms wrapped itself around Samuel's arms, and he screamed as the spectral thing tore his hands away from my neck.
"What the? Michael, what are you doing?" he yelled.
But Michael was crawling backwards across the floor, striving to escape from the rotting spirits, the decaying, lifeless forms of Sarah, Jonathan, and Bert. Living corpses, ridding their home of intruders. Their skin was charred paper and their eyes were pits of fire. But Samuel, ever the determined tyrant, shook the father's hand away and grabbed a sharpened piece of loose flooring from his side.
"I'm not dying here alone," he laughed maniacally. "You're coming with me, Hawthorne."
I screeched as the stake came plunging down, but it stopped inches from my chest. Another hand was clutching Samuel's wrist. Michael had pounced forward, saving my life with less than a second to spare. And the boy offered me a smile, a regretful smile, a tearful smile, giving that the hands of the ghoulish family were engulfing him too. But he knew what had to be done. He helped them to wrestle Samuel off me.
"No, let me go, let me,"
the bully began. With a rip like that of existence tearing itself apart, I found myself in a lightless dungeon, and all that existed in the darkness was an open doorway spilling white light through its opening. I had nowhere to go but through it. With a rush of light, sound, and feeling, I tumbled onto the Hawthorne's weed-covered front path in the early hours of the morning. A new morning, I realized. How had an entire day passed? When I scrambled to my feet, I turned back and faced the Hawthorne house. The empty, desolate Hawthorne house. Samuel, Michael, and Gary were nowhere to be seen. But I was sure, for a fleeting moment, that I caught two reddened eyes watching me from the darkness of the lobby. Before I discerned what I was truly seeing, the front door slammed shut, barring me from ever entering again. And I wouldn't dare. Not in a thousand lifetimes.
I hope you enjoyed A Night in the Hawthorne House by Dominic Eagle, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Dominic-Eagle. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/DominicEagle. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Four enter, one leaves. Not quite the exact phrase, I know, but if we could just get beyond Thunderdome, I think we'll all be okay. As we close out season 14, we end on one final tale of ghostly doings.
we return once more to another tale of Colton Trapper, Wild West ne'er-do-well, as he finds himself in a place he's long been avoiding, prison. But the chance to escape might not lead to the kind of freedom he's hoping for. Without further ado, I present to you Dead Mind. We've managed to transcribe several more reel-to-reels from the collection we located regarding Mr. Colton Trapper in St. Elizabeth of Hungary Hospital, though this time it took some doing to see if we could find some sort of order to place it into. While prior entries had introductory materials of conversation between Mr. Trapper and his unknown interviewer, these latest ones did not, and even one began in the middle of one of his monologues. At best we can tell, this is the closest we can find to a chronological entry of the prior released items. We present it as completely as possible. Missing section. Say they'll kill you, but in the end, anything will, won't it? At least I assume so. Not sure what's going to take me yet, to be honest. So anyway, yes, Jacob Simmons and Father Channon. I've told you that one before, but I don't think I mentioned that in this instance, I'd run following their deaths, but I didn't escape responsibility. I'd traveled a bit before then, and I was identified, caught, and brought before a local judge to defend my actions. As I said before, I'm more reflective now, but at the time, I was still fuming over what Jacob had done to the good father, and so I told it as honestly as I could. I watched them kill a man of the cloth, and I acted out of rage. I didn't tell them what the man of the cloth had become, because they never would have believed anyway, but the resolve in which I spoke, despite my checkered past, gave them reason to believe what I did tell them. The good news in that regard was that because the incident happened several territories away, I would need to be extradited to face justice, and therefore my punishment would be stayed until then. The bad news was, until such time as I could be, I'd be spending my time in Rosecliff Penitentiary. Ever been in penitentiary? Nah, I suppose you wouldn't have. Not many have, when you get right down to it, and most wouldn't even know how to handle themselves, especially if they didn't do anything to be there. Looking back now, life was tough then. Nowadays, you scrape your knee, you spray a little Bactine on it, put on a bandage, and you can go out dancing later that day. Back then, you bash your head on a tree branch, and if you start bleeding, you could look forward to a few days of fever, and if you recovered. Or, if really unlucky, you attracted animals that didn't exactly fear a sidearm. Sometimes it was both, though at least if a mountain lion tried to carry you off, if you were feverish, you might consider it a mixed blessing. And speaking of mixed blessings, that was what Rosecliff offered in its own strange way. Sure, you were stuck there, and when you were asked to work, you had to work, and you got paid a fraction of an honest day's wages, as long as you did what you were told. You also got a bed, a roof, and meals, which, if you lived out under the stars, wasn't always a guarantee. Of course, this was all if the staff liked you, or were at least indifferent. All that made the difference between staying an inconvenience and a living hell was if the warden, a guard, or a fellow inmate didn't like you. Didn't matter if you actually did anything. If they didn't like the way you looked, you were in far more misery than you could have ever imagined. I always believed in ghosts. But about that in a minute. I have to explain the compound first. Rosecliff was not a huge single building filled with cells like Alcatraz, all metal and small spaces. In fact, there weren't any real cells at all, since the expectation was that if you somehow got past the high stone walls that surrounded the place, you weren't going to get very far on foot. The nearest town was about 10 miles away, and chances are, if you arrived there without a horse or carriage, the town would immediately know where you came from and send you back there in a hurry. Not to say the prison was without its security. The guards kept an eye on everybody, of course, and at night the bunk area was gated off from the rest of the compound. But Colton, you might ask, what about the violent ones, the ones that needed to be kept away from everyone? For that, well, you had the hole. There was a trapdoor and down a set of dark steps. You did have a series of cells with small barred ceiling squares, so only a little bit of daylight would filter down on the luckless fellows who ended up there. They'd be given water to drink, but little else, and find themselves trapped in the dark for days on end, until most gave up on their violent tendencies and tended to behave. If they did worse, well, there were other punishments, as I was to find out. Beyond the lockup, there was a separate mess hall, administrative offices, and living quarters for the staff and warden. A large open building that was sometimes used as a workspace for large projects, such as repairing engine parts for trains or other equipment, and surprisingly, a garden. I'd heard of things like this before. The old Idaho Penitentiary, for example, was reputed to have a large rose garden for the inmates to work on, and I hear even today it's a thing to see, but this one was less successful. Don't get me wrong, it wasn't for lack of trying, but most of what grew was scraggly, bent, short, and when it came to the vegetables and fruits there, they were usually small and pitiful. Even the smallest strawberry is welcome company, with a plate of beans and overcooked beef. And then there was the mine. You see, back behind the furthest building, there was a small hillock, and beyond that, the stone wall that made the back area of the compound. But the hillock itself had a hole in it with a locking gate that led down a ways into a dark hole into the earth, where it then opened up into a space lit by the occasional candlelit safety lamps hanging from a hook on the wall. Yes, when we weren't eating, cultivating, talking, or spending our hours in the dark wondering where we should have fixed our lives, we went down in the ground digging out coal by the bucket load. Thankfully, the vein, while I was there at least, didn't descend way down into the ground, so we could walk in and out just fine. But it was still easy to get turned around because the tunnels were fairly extensive and they just went about everywhere. It wasn't fun down there. All you generally heard was the tinking of pickaxes and the rumbling of a car taking items out. But not, as you might expect, the tweeting of a canary. You see, it wasn't that long before there was an explosion across the Atlantic at a pit in Tylerstown, and the Brits had started studying and found out all about the dangers of monoxide poisoning. So there we were, oblivious to anything that we could have been breathing in. No, the biggest danger I'd seen was the pool. One of the pathways was blocked by a series of nailed-up planks. But even through the slats, you could still see into the room beyond. Well, it looked like a room. It seemed to open up, but beyond the edge of the lamplight, the rest was swallowed up in darkness. Don't want to be going in there. That's where Henry and the other four ended up. You see, they tried to escape. I guess they did, in a fashion. The one who told me was Wilson Riley, one of Rosecliff's longtime residents. He was here for the long haul, serving a very long sentence for numerous cattle thefts, assault, and general unpleasant behavior all around, to put it mildly. Still, he was genial enough and one of the few who would hold a conversation with me when I first arrived. He was surprisingly small for someone who held the reputation he did, a wiry, lean fellow with a short but matted beard, but I'd only been there a day when he got into a fist fight with another inmate over a dice game, and I was no longer surprised when I saw his tenacity. That event was my first glimpse into Warden Robert Dalton. Upon my arrival at my new estate, I'd heard talk of the warden, but it wasn't until Riley's fight that I actually had seen the man. The opposite of Riley, he was tall, broad of shoulder, with a neatly trimmed and waxed handlebar mustache. Despite the environment, he never seemed to collect a speck of dust on him, but it wasn't for lack of trying. Despite his status, he'd never been one to shy away from a difficult job or oversee events in person, though it was a rarity to hear him speak. A man of very few words, He mostly spoke either to his advisors when needed, or if he needed to speak to the population of Rosecliff at large. When he did, it was audible to everyone, and potentially to anyone within a mile or so of the prison. On the occasion of Riley's fist fight, he came walking out of the administrative building at an unhurried pace from what was likely his evening meal, wearing a black suit more fitting of an undertaker than a warden, and a Stetson that looked a little too large even on his substantial frame. He waited until a few guards separated Riley from his unfortunate and very bloodied target, then turned to address those assembled. "I remind you, violence among you men will not be tolerated." He nodded, and his guards understood his directive, lowering Riley's shirt. I noted that Riley had a number of scars along his back, letting me know this was not his first offense, nor likely to be his last. Dalton removed the belt from his waist and held it so that the buckle hung loosely from one end. "I do not do this lightly, but I'm tired of repeating myself, Riley." And with that said, he raised the belt, and with the buckle flailing, whipped Riley across the back 4 or 5 times. He grunted at the pain, and the buckle created large, angry welts along his back, or even ripped the skin open where the clasp dug in. Once the task was completed, Dalton pulled a handkerchief from his pocket and wiped his bucket clean. "Take the two of them to the infirmary, have them cleaned up, then prep Mr. Riley for a stint in the hole. One night. If he still has fight in him in the morning, then we'll go from there." There was affirmations from the staff, and Riley moaned as he was carried off. Dalton looked over the remaining gathered prisoners, and they all avoided his gaze as best they could, instead finding an interesting rock near their feet to view. That was until he saw me, blinked, then motioned for me to follow him back to the office. His office was as neat as his mustache, though it was not sparse. A file cabinet sat in one corner, a chair in front of his desk, a table behind his desk covered with papers. But the grandest item of all was a large taxidermied bald eagle, wings raised, that stood on a shelf halfway up the wall. Dalton motioned for me to sit, and I saw he was indeed taking his dinner in his office, which I assumed was something he did regularly. "Forgive me for not making your acquaintance on your arrival, Mr. Trapper. I like to meet everyone who arrives personally, but we've had an incident earlier that week that needed to be resolved. A very serious matter, which I'm sure you are already aware." "I'm not, actually. Nobody's told me anything about anything around here." Interesting. He took a bite of his biscuit, dipped some meat in a bit of gravy, and held it on the end of his fork. He swallowed before continuing. "Perhaps you're aware of Henry Fox and his gang." To his surprise, I was not, though he spent a short amount of time informing me of them. Fox was among the worst of the worst, a thieving murderer with very little conscience and even a littler patience. He'd been at Rosecliff only a short time. Like me, his was a matter of being held until extradition. But while I could make a defense, if tentative, in my own instance, in his there was no doubt of his guilt and his reasons for doing so. A Wells Fargo stagecoach had been carrying a king's ransom in cash and gold for a local bank and had the armed guards to match. Unfortunately, though, they'd expected trouble en route. They'd been expecting standard holdup men, but they did not expect a trained ex-Confederate sniper, one of Fox's men, to take them out at long range and then be subsequently slaughtered wholesale in the confusion. The driver himself, not a military or a lawman by any means, was tied to a stake and left to burn in the sun as the coach drove off. Unluckily for Fox, one of the fallen guards was not quite dead at the time, and he waited for them to assume they were not being chased before rescuing the driver and following them with vengeance on his mind. He managed to kill 4 of the gang and wound Fox himself before succumbing to his prior injuries. Fox, seeking medical aid at a small town nearby, was quickly identified and the authorities alerted. Fox responded to his charges with a shrug, saying he'd beat the hangman come hell or high water. as I was to find out, he didn't realize how right he was. That was the end of the story that Dalton told me. But the end of Fox himself was made known to me at that moment down in the mine when Riley noticed me looking into the dark room, and he grinned a crooked, toothed smile. The warden told me a little about Henry. What is that tunnel, another way out? Not exactly. Riley hefted his pickaxe on his shoulder, pointing into the depths. You see, that's a natural tunnel over that way. Never been mapped. They hit it when they were digging this tunnel, probably a few months ago. They tried to see if there was any coal, but it seems empty, and the tunnels themselves are pretty twisty and turny. It took them an hour to locate one of the guards that had gone exploring. He thought he'd been walking for over a mile when he was just going in circles. So Fox and his men got lost? No, not quite. Turns out there's a groundwater river that passes through, and lo and behold, there's a stream that comes out of the hillside a few hundred feet north of here. We occasionally have to help out in the fields, and ever since that tunnel was found, it was rumored that the stream in the cave leads all the way there. It began to fall into place. Fox and them thought they could escape through there. Yep. Of course, I don't know if you know much about cave tunnels, especially underwater, but there's knowing if there are forks in the path, or if it gets too small to fit through, or if that really connects to the exit. They did run tests, though. Fox and his men apparently wrapped some coins in a sock, seeing if it would end up outside. I never seen it happen, naturally, but shortly after, they were rumored to have tested that, and they got real excited. And nobody said anything to the guards or warden? I didn't ask it as a question. It was a simple statement that if anyone was going to escape, everyone would remain clueless. If they escaped, then nobody knew. If they didn't, then no one would admit to being part of it and be punished along with them. Well, the next morning, we all awoke to a pretty rough scene. Dalton was in the courtyard with a group of his guards, one very sorry-looking fool, and three bodies under sheets. He explained how there was an attempted breakout during the night, and Fox's gang had tried to escape into the underground river, but were discovered in the act. Two of them, men, had gotten into a scuffle with the guards and had been subsequently shot and killed. The third tried to jump into the river and escape, but cracked his head wide open on a rock, not realizing how strong the current was, and the fourth tried to lose them into tunnels, but he didn't get very far without a light, knocked himself cold running into a wall. I raised an eyebrow at him. But what about Fox? Yep, what about Fox? Dalton said he was the first one in the river, see? He went under when he heard the guards coming, according to the survivor, and that was the last anyone saw of him. He get out? Riley shrugged. I don't think so. Dalton went to check the river outside. No footprints, no disturbance in the riverside. It's assumed he probably was just swept under and drowned. That's the story, eh? Riley nodded, readjusting his pickaxe again. Yep, at least that's how it was told to us. Of course, you could have asked Charlie about it if you'd been here a week earlier. He's the one who survived, or at least survived the tunnel. He got thrown in the hole for his attempt. They found him there the next morning, pants tied around his neck, and the window bars up above. Killed himself? Riley shrugged again. That's what it looked like, at least. Of course, there's nowhere to stand in the hole, so if you wanted to hang yourself, you'd have to lean at a really awkward angle. Plus, I saw the body coming out. Man with that kind of expression when he dies. Well, I would say if he killed himself, he must not have seen it coming. I nodded, looking into the dark tunnel beyond the slats, faintly hearing the sound of the roaring waters. Sounds very convenient. Riley started to walk away. Yep, convenience is an easy thing when nobody wonders where you are or cares. I had a second meeting with Dalton, though under very different circumstances than the first. I still had no word on my awaiting fate. At this point, I thought that maybe they'd simply thrown me in here because me doing work was more useful to them than surrendering me to the hangman's noose. My time stretched here from a few days into another week, and thanks to that I had the opportunity, at mealtime, to trip and spill my plate into the lap of a dangerous fellow by the name of Kurt Amsel, apparently a former member of a Pennsylvania Dutch community. He decided to trade in his peaceful ways and simple living for running guns for outlaw groups in the Western Territories, and he didn't take kindly to the supposed insult. However, rather than make his move at the moment, he merely bided his time until I was off to take a shower. The showering area was a crude indoor affair of separate wooden stalls attached to a large factory space, with a faucet for filling a bucket that could be used for dipping a cloth in or dumping over oneself, depending on level of dirt or desire to freeze yourself solid in the midday heat. No fancy hot water here. There were 10 of us in there when Kurt moved himself to the stall next to mine. I anticipated him trying something. I didn't think he'd have an accomplice grabbing me from the other side, trying to press my neck against the wall of the stall, blocking my windpipe and making me choke. Kurt then took his turn to begin socking me in the kidneys until I wrapped my legs around his and tripped him, knocking him down and smacking the back of his head against the concrete floor. It wasn't a loud crack like I'd hoped, and he was back on his feet in moments, but I'd been able to use the time to reach up and press my thumbs into my other attacker's windpipe, causing him to release his grip on me and give me a fighting chance to get on my feet. Kurt was vicious, but I could tell very quickly he was not used to a fair fight. I dusted my knuckles on him a few more times, and a few well-placed kicks to his fellow in arms ensured I kept it to a one-on-one show. I heard whooping and hollering from the others, but whether they were on my side or his, I couldn't be sure. Still, when I heard footsteps running into the room, I immediately backed off, knowing that the last thing I needed was the guards to start laying into me. The first one to stop throwing punches, I've learned in my time, is the first one to be heard and the last to take a club to the head. I was glad to have been right this time around. Kurt and the other man were given a few sour raps until the fight went out of them completely, but I avoided any kind of discipline, at least of that kind. I did find myself in one of the cells in the hole, which I had already expected would happen, but I was only there for maybe 15 minutes before I was brought and escorted to Dalton's office. Unlike my previous visit, I was not interrupting his mealtime, but he was dressed less formally than normal, wearing work clothes, gloves, and a duster jacket. It looked more like he'd been out doing cattle ranching than being the head of the prison. "Mr. Trapper, care to explain the events of the past hour?" I told him as best I could. He nodded much of the time, before steepling his fingers and leaning back in his chair. "You know, Mr. Trapper, you don't seem like the kind of man to shoot someone in cold blood. You can take care of yourself, clearly, but I've kept my eye on you in my own way, and your actions since you've been here do not jibe with the reason you are here." I harumped, still feeling soreness in my throat. "I've done things in my life I'm not proud of, that's a fact, and I'll probably go to my grave starting purgatory at the very beginning. But at least I know not to be proud of those actions." "I see. Yet despite this veritable list of items of your criminal past, there's also both a notation here of great service to the community of Salt Rock, as well as a collected bounty in service to the law. And you're here now for killing three men who, a few moments before, killed a priest in cold blood. That is what you say I'm accused of. Sounds like, to me, you're a man trying to get into heaven but are getting lost. Would that sound about right?" I shrugged. "That makes about as much sense as anything else I've ever done." He leaned back in his chair, and for a moment he looked up at that bald eagle above his head, as if it was a sign from the Lord and seeking its guidance. According to the late Charles Westhammer, Henry Fox went underwater and never came back out. I can confirm, because I, too, came into that cave and saw him dive under. As I'm sure you've been told, the body was never recovered. Yes, no sign he escaped. Correct. And again, what do you need from me? I need you to find out why people keep saying they've seen Henry Fox in that cave where he's supposed to be dead. I had fully expected Riley to be the one he was speaking of, but he was not. It was actually one of his officers supervising things in the mine who happened to glance through the boards into the cave itself. He could not be mistaken, he later told Dalton. There was a man on the other side of the boarded tunnel standing in the darkness beyond. No light source was visible, and when he called out, the man turned and vanished out of sight. And by vanished, he meant vanished. He did turn and start to walk, but the figure had not gone deep enough to be hidden from the lamplight. He appeared to have actually dissolved from view, fading away just before he would have been swallowed by the dark. He'd never seen anything like it. It was unnatural, and he refused to go back into the mine. At that point in the conversation, the guard became unglued, Dalton told me, and began raving about how Charlie might have been done in by whatever spirit dwelled under the earth. I told him, of course, that unless one of my own men had taken the law into his own hands, Charles had indeed taken a coward's way out. But I tell you, Mr. Trapper, that after seeing the terror in that dead man's eyes, I tell you, I cannot deny his story entirely. But my men are rattled, and they do not rattle easily. But how would he know that it was Fox? He just saw a shape. It could be anybody that could have gotten past the barricade. Dalton folded his arms. The barricade's been up since the incident took place. The original nails are still in place, and the boards are stuck tight. No one could have gotten past it, in or out. And that's why I need someone to go down there and see. But that's the problem. I need it to be after hours, when the other prisoners are asleep and accounted for, and a guard near the entrance, both for your safety and ours. Can you do this? I can, but I still don't know why you feel I'm right for this. Surely one of your guards is better armed and more trustworthy than I am. Dalton sighed. When I saw the notation from Marshal Wilkes, I sent him a telegraph. He didn't tell me much, but he did say you were involved with an unusual situation. You may be the only person I've ever met who has had experience with things that don't make any rational sense. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having this conversation. With a recommendation like that, how could I refuse? I returned to the quarters until evening fell, and it was some time before I finally heard a shuffling at the gate and was let out by a solitary guard holding his lamp in front of him. He led me to that hole in the ground, handed me a lamp of my own, and followed me down into the pit. Without the sounds of the pickaxe and the carts, all that could be heard was our footsteps, and it was not a sound that fell well in the echo of that underground cavern. We both arrived at the planked entrance, at which point the guard gave me a crowbar, and together we pulled the boards away with loud, ear-splitting creaks. We left the boards in a pile, and the guard nodded at me to go on, while he stayed there, refusing to take another step. I looked into the cavern beyond and how it opened up into a larger space. I could now hear the roar of the underground river, and to be fair, I was glad for that small noise. "Sure you don't want to come with me?" The guard shook his head. "I don't believe in ghosts, but I still can't shake the feeling I get looking in there. I think some evil is lingering there." "And if it came for Charlie? Standing right here won't save you, you know. It can reach all the way to the hole." "Then I'd prefer it to stretch. You run into the trouble, you holler, and I'll do what I can. But if it ain't human, then I don't know if I'd be much help." On the one hand, it struck me why I was even bothering with this, when even these lawmen were as yellow as a bag of mustard. But even I could feel a sort of dread in the cavern beyond. I honestly don't know if I really wanted to find out who or what lay inside, but I still pressed on. Also, I had a vague clinging hope that somehow solving this could give me an extension, more time, to delay the sentence I was sure would pass upon me. That certainty terrified me more than any phantom. But, to be fair, being underground in the dark with an unknown was a very close second. Lighting my way, I saw the world open up around me. The cavern almost didn't seem like it should fit in this place, rising maybe 20 feet over my head. I didn't think we were far enough underground for that to be possible. Maybe it was just a matter of the slope of the ground. Or an errant thought came through my head, that maybe it wasn't possible. Perhaps that was why this place caused so much dread. Maybe there was more to it than a simple cavern. I finally stepped in far enough that the tunnels that everyone had mentioned came into view, turning and twisting ahead of me. I thought there would be one or two, but there were at least 6 or 7, and again it made me wonder if that could happen naturally, or if someone had done it by hand. I stepped into one on the left, following it, listening to see if the rush of the water was getting closer. Instead, after about 2 minutes of wandering, I found myself back in the main chamber, having come back through one of the tunnels. Had I hit any curves in the tunnel? How could I double back? No, this had to be a matter of the time of night, tiredness, and my mind wanting to believe things were stranger than they actually were. Yeah, that's what I needed to tell myself. I took another tunnel, and this time I definitely paid attention to turns. Left, right, a fork where I took a leftward angle, always listening to hear if I was approaching the river. Dalton. I wasn't mistaking that noise. The whispered, rasping echo noise off the walls ahead. Fox? Dalton. Bring me Dalton. I took a few steps forward, and there on the edge of my vision was a shadow of a man, close-torn, ragged, dark and wrinkled skin, eyes burning with a cold blue light before moving further up the tunnel. I moved forward again, almost running now, but reminding myself a slip, a fall, down here by myself, could mean I was never found. I came out again into a larger chamber, and for a moment I thought that I'd come back into the main room again, and stopped myself to ready for another trip back. Then I looked down. This was not the main chamber, not even close. This was a much larger tunnel, going who knows where beneath the surface of the earth. But the tunnel I'd come from came to an abrupt end, going down maybe 10 or 15 feet on jagged, bent rocks below. And there was a shape down there. My lantern couldn't catch the exact shape due to the distance, but I could draw a guess. And the guess made me wonder about a whole bunch of different things. I returned back the way I'd come, and this time the world seemed to make sense. I emerged back out into the mine where the guard was waiting. I told him I'd need to speak to Dalton, and quickly. Wait here, I'll go get him. I waited in silence at the mine for a few minutes. Before the guard returned, Dalton and Toe, both carrying lanterns. I led them into the cavern, then down the tunnel, remembering the pattern I'd followed. I don't think there may be another exit out of this cavern. It's possible somebody might be coming in and out that way, and that may be what we're seeing. Yeah, I knew it was a lie, but it was to judge their reactions. For the guard, and I saw him appear to visibly relax, that there was a rational explanation for all of this. Dalton, on the other hand, tensed further. I think he could sense I wasn't being honest about this, and it gave me more information on what I needed to know. We emerged into that enormous tunnel once more, and I looked down the cliff face to the shape of the bottom. The guard looked down, and he too saw the shape. Sir, what is that down there? Dalton, white-faced, backed away from the cliff. He hasn't moved. Then who is it? Sir, what are you talking about? I then saw the dark shape forming behind Dalton, stepping forward into the light of our lanterns. The wizened, darkened shape of a man with cold blue eyes, shrunken and hate-filled. The guard gasped, "Sir, behind you!" He leapt into the space between Dalton and the shape, pulling his revolver as it turned. Sadly, it deterred nothing. The shape reached out, clasping cold fingers around the guard's throat, and I watched in horror as his skin paled His eyes rolled up into his head, and his skin began to flake and rot, leaving him a husk that the shape dropped at our feet. Dalton fell on his knees, looking up at the specter, and began to pray. In Latin, I realized, as if speaking in the dead tongue would give it extra power. I watched the spirit draw closer to him, and it turned to me, smiling broadly, the twisting rictus of the dead mouth, ready to take its prize. I knew revenge was on its mind, and it would soon have it. I didn't like that smile. I hoped nothing would ever smile like that at me ever again. And in my mind, there was a click of something I could do. The fallen guard's lamp lay on the ground, fallen there as his fingers shriveled to nothing. Grabbing it, I leaned over the cliff and, hoping my aim would be true, threw it at the shape of the rocks below. I heard a hissing snarl behind me, and I felt a cold chill move in my directions and fingers wrapped around my arm. I felt a horrible cold, and it began to spread quickly. But what Fox had planned for me, it was too late. The lantern smashed open, and his corpse, now fully visible in the broken lantern, caught fire as the fuel spread across him, and I heard a howl from the spirit. I turned to look and watched the form begin to dissolve, staring at me, the blue eyes turning red with fury before the shape dissipated, dispersing through the air. Dalton, eyes shut, still reciting his prayer, seemed oblivious to the events that had just transpired. I slapped him on the shoulder and he opened his eyes, looking to see the burning body down the cliff and his attacker nowhere to be seen.
You stopped him. You destroyed him.
Should I have? I knelt down. You lied. You said you saw Fox go into the river and drown, but he didn't. He's been here. Dalton took a moment to gather himself, swallowing hard. No, you're right. The others did put up a struggle, and the one man did bash his head in the underwater, but Charles and Henry both fled into the tunnels. They ended up at this cliff, and they argued and fought. Charles almost went over the cliff, but I had followed them, and in the end I pushed Henry, and he fell. He stood, but his gaze continued to stare at the burning body below. But as I was escorting Charles, I heard him calling. The fall hadn't killed him. He was calling for help, for mercy, for aid. But we had no tools. We had no way of getting him help. I didn't know how hurt he was, and if we would come back, and he'd be dead. I was not going to risk the life of my men for him. He was to be tried for his crimes. He was headed for the hangman, no matter what. And I made a choice. And Charles agreed, having almost come to an end at Henry's hands himself, that we say he drowned and there was no body to recover. Why? Why the story? I wanted no more chances, no more escapes. Death lies either way, whether in that pit or that river. But when I heard there was somebody still walking around, I thought perhaps he had survived, and that he would want his revenge. I needed to know. I nodded, and going in yourself, if anyone knew what happened. Mr. Trapper, I consider myself a harsh man, but I have never regretted what I've done. This was a first. He turned now to the form of the guard on the ground. And look, how it spreads. This man did nothing, and now I must write his widow. How do I explain it? I stood next to him. I don't know. If I did, the world would make a lot more sense. The light below us began to fade as the fire petered out, and soon it was just our lanterns. Mr. Trapper, do you believe in redemption? Well and truly? I hope for it, but I don't know what I need to get to it. Then I need to pay you for the service provided. The guard changes in the next 20 minutes at the front gate. Outside there's an Appaloosa. She's old and getting on in years, and the man she belongs to has been looking to sell her without success. He will be compensated. I blinked. Not an innocent man, Mr. Dalton. Neither am I. But if you're the kind of man I think you are, then earn that redemption. I did as he instructed, and I left Rosecliff behind. I never looked back until I was long gone, and by the time the word spread that there was a breakout, I was already doing ranch work far off. I still don't quite understand the world. I never met Robert Dalton again, but I did hear word of him. In the early 1910s, there was a fire at Rosecliff, and apparently he had single-handedly rescued a number of inmates, but died of smoke inhalation in the process, and he was buried with honors. But as I've aged and looked back on my life in reflection, it makes me wonder if I'd followed Fox to take him, get his revenge. In a sense, that would have been justice served, would it not? After all, he did leave Fox there to die in the cold and alone, and his ghost, or whatever it was, down in those tunnels, would have had every right to exact its vengeance. But is vengeance justice? Fox was not some repentant. He'd done things that I would never even consider wishing upon a human being, and had done so in sheer cold blood. In that sense, Dalton had acted in defense of another to push him. And leaving him there was, by all accounts, a sensible act. But it does weigh on the conscience to knowingly allow someone to die, to make a choice that there's nothing that one can do. I'm sure doctors do it all the time. In the end, sometimes there are not good choices versus bad, but what can only be some shade of which choice is worse. I'd never really been a leader, though, and had to be the one to make those choices. I'd only ever worried about myself, and I had to admit, at that time, I was glad not to be in Dalton's shoes. Of course, I've had a long life, and life has a way of making you do things you wish you never had to do. Unknown. I can see I'm almost out of tape again. Glad we were able to wrap this story up in time. I unfortunately don't have more time today to hear more, Mr. Trapper. But it sounds like there, at the end, that you've had to deal with something very difficult later in life. Colton. Huh. Gave it away, did I? Unknown. Well, perhaps we can speak to that next time. When would you like me to return? Colton. You don't have to come back. I'm sure my life is very fascinating to listen to, but you don't have to record all of it. Maybe some of my stories are best left buried. Unknown. Sometimes the hardest stories are the ones we need to hear the most. Colton. Easy for you to say. You're not the one telling them. Recording stops. I hope you enjoyed Dead Mine by Seth Paul, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Seth-Paul. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/SETH-PAUL. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. And once again, I would like to give a nice big thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Yes, we're calling an end to Season 14, but not to worry. Season 15's picking up with more all-new tales to terrify you. I don't want to give too much away, but stay tuned for stories of out-of-controlled creations, cosmic horrors, and, of course, that always of pleasant stories, radiation monstrosities. If you've enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts, and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference, and it would mean a lot to us. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, You can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases, and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyrie channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyrie. Until next week and our brand new season, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?